I have with me Susan Zakin, who is an author who has just written a book about Katrina. Could you tell us the title of the book,
Susan? It's an Amazon Kindle single, and it's called Hurricane Season, What Katrina Taught America.
And what did Katrina teach America?
Well, maybe I should have titled it What We Hope Katrina Taught America. I actually had written an earlier version of this essay for a book of photographs right soon after Katrina hit. So I was, it was an assignment for me because I had written a couple of articles about Katrina. I had lived in New Orleans, and I got to go to New Orleans soon after Katrina. I went to the first Mardi Gras after Katrina. Katrina showed many of us anyway was the it was a wake-up call about inequality. It was so stark in Katrina and in the Superdome, and with so many of the more affluent people being able to get out of the city while others kind of sweated and suffered and many died. So that was that, and it was also what I tried to get across in this book. And this is, it just came out. It was chosen as a Kindle single, which was great. Was the really intimate relationship between nature and culture, and that's also very clear in a place like New Orleans, which has such a rich culture.
Yeah, and just to remind our listeners, this is Susan Zakin, and I am Matthew Tombers, and this is the Wednesday version of WGXE's morning show. Susan, this is all hurricanes all the time, now.
It does seem to be, yes.
Yeah, and I just a friend of mine just sent me some photographs from St. John in the Virgin Islands, which is just devastated.
Yeah, and I think that's getting those places maybe getting a bit overlooked by the U.S. media because we've gotten so focused on our
Florida.
And national news rather than international news. What's happening in Cuba is very interesting too. I wrote about Hurricane Harvey for the Los Angeles Review of Books, and I am actually planning to write more about that because what the fear is with hurricane after hurricane is we'll forget about a place where there are still lessons to be learned and places that are and there's work to be done and there's possibility of making the same mistakes that got us to this place, and Houston's a very good example of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking to people in Houston now. One young man he's just publishing his second novel, and he was in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and his mom is a major activist in Houston on real estate development, and what he is saying, and several other people that I've been talking to, because I'm planning to do a longer piece, is this is a man-made disaster, and that's something that we need to kind of hold in the balance. Certainly, it's not that I'm certainly not denying climate change, but there are I think three levels at which we can look at this phenomenon, particularly in Houston, and then Florida will be another story.
Okay. In what way is this a man-made disaster? I have some ideas, but I think it would be good for our listeners to hear how this is a man-made disaster.
I should say in a more qualified way, maybe more than 50% man-made. You know, Houston is, we all know, the oil business, right? It's the ship channel. It's, you know, and that's a great level of symbolism for climate change, that this is the dark beating heart of the oil business. But it's actually quite diversified economy now. Houston is the country's fourth largest city. It's mm-hmm. gaining on Chicago. And it is the only major city in the United States with no zoning. I think you may have read that in various articles. But there's really more to it than that. The real estate developers run the town. They run the politics. It doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican. And they have siphoned off redevelopment funds, essentially, to build upscale malls and things like that through a mechanism that is too tedious to go into for listeners in New York, I think. So I think, emblematic of a lot of, especially southwestern cities, but the way real estate development works in the United States. So one of, and because they're so powerful, nobody has required these real estate developers to do what they were actually supposed to do, which was to build these holding ponds for water.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's a sort of stupid, mechanical, boring water management problem on the very micro level.
Yes.
But
which in Florida is, you know, they've controlled water so well that it has nowhere to go.
It's destroying the Everglades. But so that's something to look at all communities. One of the things that I've found sort of fascinating was to sort of see the nature of real estate developers, given that we have one as president. And people talk about, there was actually an article about Trump and talking about him as a real estate developer. These guys do not give up. They have a sense of self-righteousness about what they do, and they fight like cornered wolverines when they're opposed. They just keep coming. They keep coming. And this is what happens. So there's that sort of local circle of hell. And of course, Houston, because it was a port, was built on wetlands. So that's, mm-hmm. you know, that's a given. But there's also the national level, which is that FEMA is underfunded. The National Flood Insurance Program is started off with good intentions, and, you know, kind of got a little hazy around the edges. Originally, people who were living in flood-prone areas were going to get subsidies. Apparently, 80% of Houstonians were not considered to be living in a floodplain, so now they have no insurance. And I think there are loans available through the Small Business Administration. If anyone has relatives in Houston who are freaking out now, that's something good to know. But, you know, there's a larger issue here. How many times do we rebuild? Where does that reconstruction money go? What I wrote in the LA Review of Books piece was, you know, this is the closest thing to a deus ex machina that Donald Trump's administration is going to get. He's finally passing a piece of legislation, which is reconstruction money for Houston, and this gives him a chance to hand out patronage. To the great fear of people in Houston is that the money will go to the developers. Also to companies, I think it's a pretty good bet, companies like Halliburton and Bechtel that swoop in an emergency. I think that, you know, there's a third kind of more symbolic, big picture, more future oriented level to this, which is when you look, Matt, you and I talked about this, these really emotional pictures and videos of people forming human chains to rescue, you know, an elderly man from a car. That was the one mm-hmm. that really struck me. The Hispanic guys who died when they were rescuing people and their boat hit a power line. It shorted out. Mexico offering us aid and now rescinding that offer because of the president not expressing any sympathy over their earthquake. But this sense that seems to be growing that we only have ourselves to rely on. And that's not to show any disrespect to FEMA, which did quite a good job this time. They learned from Katrina. Trump hadn't gotten around to cutting their budget yet. And they were coordinating really well with state and local mm-hmm. authorities and the firefighters. But it wasn't enough. And how many times will we be able to rebuild in the floodplain as these hurricanes grow more frequent and mm-hmm. more intense? And
Susan, yeah. what should happen in Houston?
What should happen?
What should happen in Florida?
There is already a move in Houston to retire some of the places that are the most flood prone. Mm-hmm. They should clean up the government in Houston. And I think that, you know, there needs to be a serious look at infrastructure at these detention ponds in Houston, so that flooding can be controlled. But, you know, we've got a larger problem in the country because of the climate change and coastal flooding.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be, I think those detention ponds need to be built. I mean, that's a very mechanical and distinct fix.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a start. But you know what was interesting about Houston is that the poor and the middle class and the upper middle class and the wealthy were flooded alike.
Yes.
That's very, very interesting. And that really shows how low-lying Houston is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the reasons that real estate developers, and I know this is of interest to people in Greenport right now, real estate developers have inordinate power. I talked to a political science professor in Santa Barbara, one of the very, very few communities that have been able to stop sprawl, is they're repeat players with the planning and zoning boards. They're repeat, they come back, they know the people, they have an ongoing relationship, they know the system, whereas the people opposing development tend to be one-time players in the mm-hmm. system. They're neighbors, they galvanize around something in their neighborhood, and they don't have, of course, the firepower that the developers have, but they also don't have the knowledge of the system. So, if we had, in an ideal world, we would also be looking at how we develop, how we build our communities. And that's not to say necessarily stopping a development. It's just looking at all the aspects of development.
Yes. We're facing this in Columbia County. We're facing it in Greene County. It's not that people are necessarily against development. It's what kind of development and how is development handled. And I think that one of the things that I took away from Houston was the great generosity of the human spirit that arose in the people that came out, the Cajun Navy. Mm. I was in the parking lot of the post office in Claverick, and I was hearing a story. It was the son of a former governor of Texas who had a 20-foot fishing boat and a 20-horsepower motor, and he and his friends organized the rescue of 100 people, including a man with cerebral palsy that they debated whether they should leave him or take him, and they took him, and it was kind of dangerous because the boat could, tip over pretty easily. But they came back a few hours later, and where he was 5 feet underwater where he had been.
Oh, wow.
So if he hadn't gone, he would have died. And then all the people from Louisiana who brought their boats over to Houston, because Houstonians had come in Katrina to help them. I just broke down in the parking lot.
I also cried when I was looking at the Cajun Navy coming in, because I remembered spending that time in New Orleans after Katrina and how passionate everybody was, especially at that first Mardi Gras, where everybody from all walks of life were at the Mardi Gras. And it meant so much to them. It wasn't what we used to think of as the drunkathon. It was really a community
outpouring
of. I mean, you know, this woman that I just spoke to, Donna Friedman, was so amazing. I was on the phone with her.
She's the activist.
And her son, Mike Friedman, actually wrote his first novel about Houston and about some of this crooked stuff and the politics. But this woman she's a nurse, and her husband is a pediatrician. And they had volunteered in the Houston Astrodome for the Katrina. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to call them refugees. I forget what. But the people fleeing.
You know, I think that what we may be doing, Susan, because I hear a train coming.
Ah, we should play a little song. How about Neville Brothers?
Let's play a little music, because I think we're going to be hearing a train. Let's see what we've got here that we can play. Ida Lupino. Let's play Ida Lupino by Giovanni Guidi. And for those of you who don't remember, Ida Lupino, which was the song we just heard, was an American actress and director who was very influential in the 50s and the 60s, and was one of the few first female directors in the movie business. An interesting lady. So we're back. This is Matthew Tombers. This is the Wednesday version of WGXC's morning show. And this is Matthew Tombers, and I'm here with Susan Jakin, and we were talking before the train came about Houston, and we were just about to get into the adventures of Donna Friedman and her children who are volunteering in Houston.
Well, I had the most delightful conversation with Donna last night. And I had actually talked to her son first, who's in New York now because his apartment was flooded out. But he had been volunteering down in Houston. He's the author of a book called School Days, I think it is, and now just publishing his second book. This is an incredible family. So she's a nurse, and her husband is a pediatrician. They live in a very nice part of Houston, and they were not flooded. But because she's you know, a good-hearted person and a nurse that has a useful skill, she had volunteered during Katrina when people came to the Astrodome. And so she's also been an activist on these zoning issues, on these urban planning issues. Apparently, there are all these women. And they're nice ladies, you know. They you can tell they're, from my Yankee perspective, they are Southern ladies, right? And they are so feisty, duck and cover. And they've been fighting these development battles. Anyway, I was on the phone with her last night, and she was telling me about going to the Superdome with her husband. And she called her very first call. She called a hotel and said, you know, we'd love some donations. They gave her 1,000 toothbrushes. They gave her razors. They gave her all the toiletries that they have in their rooms. And that was her first phone call. They didn't say no to her. They didn't hesitate. And she and her husband went to the shelter. And she did say that, you know, it was a bit like New Orleans, that many of the people were people of color. And she said there was one woman who was about 60, and she was all alone, and she was terrified to go to sleep in the shelter. And but they keep the lights on all the time. And she said, well, you know, the cops are here, it's probably okay. But can you imagine how scary? I'd be scared to go to sleep. So it was really moving talking to her, and she's had neighbors who have been flooded repeatedly, and these, you know, these are middle class neighborhoods. So she's kind of seen the range of effects. Her son, it was really cute. Her son was in Iraq and Afghanistan, and is now writing. He's got an MBA. Very interesting guy. Really energetic and cool. And when this happened, he ran to Louisiana. They have family in Louisiana. He went and got a boat. He came, and then the current was so strong, they were losing it. And he just sort of said, what am I doing? I'm just out of my depth here playing hero. And he went instead to volunteer to muck out houses. And he's the more socially conscious one. Her other son is a business guy, but he lives downtown. And he said, Mom, I was watching this. He's not an activist. And he went and volunteered too. So when you're talking about that sense of just immediate emotional response, I think that neighborliness is very strong there. And I find it's very strong in a lot of places in the West. There's none of that city kind of, oh, I'm not going to look at you because you're in trouble, you know, that you see in New York City where I grew up. People just, they just come out.
Well, you know, I think I was in New York on 9/11, and I think there's been a shift in the city since then. I think it's shifting back to the way it was in a way. But there was a period in there where everyone was very sensitive to other people.
You know, I have heard that. I have heard that. And in my mind, I had just come back from Madagascar. And there was I was training environmental journalists there. And I was in Tucson, where I used to live, sleeping on a sleeping porch in the desert on an old ranch. I was house-sitting for a friend. And I heard about 9/11. Her ex-mother-in-law called, a very older woman in Maine, and said, "Oh, have you seen it on television? It's just awful." I didn't know what she was talking about. There was no television. And I remember thinking that compared, it didn't affect me until I talked to my mother, who was living in the city. It didn't affect me as much as Katrina. And I am not sure why. I think maybe I tuned it out. But both of those events coming so close together, 9/11, I mean, there were 7,000 people killed in 9/11. Many of them got biographies in the New York Times. There were 7,000 children who died of malnutrition in Madagascar during the contested election who no one paid attention to. So that was sort of my... But I think that comparison is actually quite apt, because both of these events were blows to our myth of American exceptionalism, that somehow these things didn't happen here. And one of my, what I feel might be the greatest lesson that we can learn from these events, from this string of hurricanes, I think I called them a fatal chorus line or something in my piece, is that we are not immune. We have not engineered ourselves out of a relationship with nature.
Absolutely not.
Our resources are finite. Our government is not the government that we had in the 1960s that provided a safety net for people, that it is becoming more like the governments in other countries that have been hammered by international bankers and have had to cut back on government services. And that's neoliberal capitalism that Naomi Klein has written about in The Shock Doctrine. So we may be becoming a country where we rely on the informal economy, where we rely on the kindness of strangers. Mm-hmm. And the sooner we can arrest that trend, the better we can take that generosity and that kindness and
institutionalize it?
Yeah, turn it into government policy. Go back to the Rousseauian idea that we're all in it together. And you know, I love American independence, the sense of self-reliance and independence, but it's not an article of religious faith of it has its limits.
I think that I was in Delhi when Katrina hit. And I watched it from the Oberoi Hotel, and I kept thinking, this isn't happening in America.
Yeah.
But it was. I couldn't believe it, because it was so disorganized. And there was, you know, we've learned a lot of lessons from them. And as you said, FEMA did a much better job, though they were almost out of money, and they now have money to begin to work with, but it's going to cost $150 billion to rebuild Houston.
An amazing amount of money.
Plus, yeah. You know, we've got all of what Irma did to Florida.
Yeah.
Jose is kind of coming along, and there's after that, there's another storm, Kate or something.
And nothing is changing in the government. In fact, by giving more political power, by everybody coming together in a crisis, which is great, I think that the Trump administration and the very radical anti-government Republicans that he has empowered is actually going to get a boost. So we'll see even more assaults on regulation than we have previously seen. I mean, Trump may not have been able to get legislation through, but he's done an enormous amount
of rolling back regulations all over the place. Yeah. And it is interesting to watch, because there is the very public thing that's going on and all the noise, and then there's this very quiet thing that's been going on, which has been the deregulation of American society.
And as someone who's covered the environment, I've seen a lot that a lot of it is very harmful to the environment, and because the environment is such a kind of special, it's a kind of a little information ghetto. Mm-hmm. That, unless you're a true believer, you don't really know about it. So it's kind of flying under the radar.
Right, Susan. We're coming up toward the end of the hour, and we'll be followed by Maria Manhattan in the Hudson Cafe.
Cool.
And this is WGXC, Acra, Hudson, Catskill, the voice of Greene and Columbia counties. Do become a sustaining sponsor. Go to WGXC.org/donate so that we can spend more time having conversations with people like Susan and listening to great music from people like Maria Manhattan. And have to worry less about fundraising, because it does take money, even though this is a station that is programmed by 100 volunteers ranging in age from 9 to nearly 90. We are a great radio station, unlike almost any other place in the world. Susan, what's your summation? What's the last thing you want to say before we listen to a little music and blend into Maria Manhattan's time?
Pay attention to what's going on in your local communities, and remember that we have a president who is the real estate developer in chief.